And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your no-show, the Block Talk Radio show on the Renford Broadcast Network that addresses what you know and how you are showing up in the world and how you are making a difference, helping where you can, doing the right thing, not because anyone is looking, but simply because it is the right thing to do, and you have to do the right thing. It is a thing, as Charles Fillmore said at the ripe young age of 94, that made him say, "I fairly sizzle with zeal and spring forth with a mighty faith and enthusiasm to do that which ought be done by me." What is it that you are doing, and how is it that you are making a difference in your home, in the neighborhood where you live, in your city, state, and in the nation? Are you a New Thought metaphysician, and what does that mean anyway? Well, New Thought metaphysics simply means a new way of thinking, coloring outside of the lines, the box, and when necessary, creating coloring pencils and chalk never seen before, as we move beyond the physical and discuss the metaphysical aspects of spiritual intervention that incorporates the wisdom of yesterday with the technology of today. My name is Robert J.V. McMillan, and it is my pleasure to serve as your host and to invite spirit-filled people who either know who they are or are learning that very quickly and then taking that information into the world, beginning with their neighborhoods, their friends, co-workers, mosques, temples, synagogues, shoeshine parlors, McDonald's, and ice cream stores, and asking the most important question that anyone can ever ask of anyone. And that question is, how can I help? What can I do to help make your life better? What can I do to help you understand me a little bit more? And by extension, I then understand you more. And we are able to discuss our similarities instead of our differences. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. This is the No Show. Many years ago, a young gentleman of around 3 or so years of age said to me as I was photographing he and his brothers in his grandmother's office in Washington, D.C., "Mr. Wobbett, you are so awesome. You have not ever been truly complimented until a 2 or 3 year old tells you you are awesome." Our God, universal impersonal principle, is, as the songwriter suggests, an awesome God. And my guest tonight is awesome as well, and has the uncanny ability to help us to understand the traditional Bible in ways that we have never understood it before. In other words, he is a biblical metaphysicist. We are so pleased tonight to welcome to the No Show Reverend C. Michael Woodstock, an ordained minister of United Centers for Spiritual Living and a graduate of the Holmes Institute for Consciousness Studies, with an M.A. in Consciousness Studies. He also holds a B.A. in Business Law and Office Administration from Michigan State University. And he is a licensed religious science practitioner, and he got that in 2005. Reverend C. tells us that he is passionate about unlocking the spiritual power that lies beneath the English translations of the Bible and empowering people to do this for themselves as well. His lectures and classes on the Bible are empowering and have inspired many to look at the Judeo-Christian Bible in a fresh way, as Ernest Holmes did in the writing of The Science of Mind. And we are so pleased to have him with us tonight. We are so happy that he decided to stop by here for just a moment and to do things in the wonderful way that only he can do. Good evening, sir. Are you with us? Good evening, Reverend C.
I'm certainly with you, and thank you so much for your kind words, sir.
It is my pleasure. It is my pleasure. It's always easy to tell the truth, and so that's a good thing to do, and probably is also the best thing to do, because that way, as my granny used to tell me, Reverend C., if you tell the truth, baby, then you don't have to remember what you said. And as I get older, I'm really becoming more appreciative of that, because I seem to forget a lot more than at times I know. So that's a good thing. We are so happy to have you here with us. Miss Carrie Kelly is also on the line with us, and will be coming in to ask a few questions in a little while. And Tendai Jordan, a very good and wonderful friend of this particular show and this moderator, and a friend of yours, also is on the line. So we are excited about having others to join us as well. And I would share with you, ladies and gentlemen, you may join the program if you're listening online. You may ask a question by calling in at 347-838-9142. And if you will then, once you have done that, called in, press 1 so that we will know that you would like to make a comment or ask a question, then we will be happy to bring you into the fray. Reverend C., why don't you just go ahead and give us your opening relative to what your background and your history is and how it is that you became involved in what you are doing now, and what is the what I know this is your passion already, but what is it that you're getting from this that keeps that fire burning in your heart?
Well, I'm happy to talk about that, of course. Where it all really started for me was in the Vietnam War. I was just graduated from Michigan State, gotten a job, and was working in a temporary agency where one of the clients, Michigan Blue Shield, was going to pick me up and make me a management trainee when I got drafted. And at the time, I was working in Detroit, driving down Jefferson Avenue every day. If you're familiar with Detroit, it runs parallel to the river, the Detroit River. And every day, I would ride by both the tunnel, the entrances to the tunnel and the bridge to Windsor, and be thinking in my mind, all I really have to do here is flick my wrist, and I'm out of here. And making that choice, I talked to my mother about it, and what I came away with was her statement, it's your turn. And that's what shifted it for me. I decided to go to Vietnam primarily because if I didn't go, it wasn't that Uncle Sam was going to get one less man. He was just going to get one other man, probably a working-class man, a person of color.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not so much patriotism as it was a sense of duty and responsibility and a simple sense of equity.
Mm.
And then when I got to Vietnam, the education began. And I'm telling you, you want to know where my passion around the struggle for equity and justice in terms of racism and white supremacy, it was when I got to Vietnam and saw the differential treatment accorded people of color there, including our own soldiers.
Uh-huh.
And the further I got out in the field, and I was a medic, by the way, so the further I got out in the field, the more and more African-American GIs I saw.
Uh-huh.
And the difference in the treatment, the difference in the casualty rates, and all of that began to just like open my eyes further and further. So when I got back, interestingly enough, I got involved in the anti-war movement. But what happened was I got an offer for, I got someone who was a person on the radio station in Windsor, CKLW there, across the river in Detroit, and very much a person doing the same sort of thing you are, wanted to interview me about my work for Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And so I did that and, told them about my experience. The next day I get a call from my mother, and she says, what were you saying on the radio? And I told her what I said about my understanding of the real reasons we were in Vietnam, having more to do with racism and imperialism and profit. And she said, well, the house got trashed.
Oh.
The house where I grew up. And rubbish and painting on the windows and all kinds of stuff. And she said, and so-and-so, who owns a barber shop on Main Street, says if you ever show up in town again, he's got a shotgun in his shop waiting for you.
Oh, my goodness.
That was my introduction to what happens to people who show up as an ally, people who show up
wow.
as someone who is taking a stance for justice for folks in the target group, who is a person that is in the privileged group himself. So that's where it started all those years ago. So, you know, long story short, I went through a period of, you know, struggles with alcohol and drugs and post-traumatic stress and all of that until I hit my spiritual renewal in the 90s, joined what was to become CSL, you know, became a practitioner and then a minister, and then began my deep studies with the Judeo-Christian Bible with my current mentor, Dr. Will Coleman, out of Atlanta, starting to learn about the Western roots of mysticism and ancient Kemetic and West African spiritual traditions and how that has impacted and really shaped both, you know, in fact, all the major religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, with the philosophy of Africa. So that's it in a nutshell.
Wow. You know, it's so fascinating that out of challenge and what we would consider to be ignorance and racism comes understanding. But we have to go through something, it seems, in order to then be okay and stand up and know that what we are doing is exactly what it is that we need to do. And it helps us to then fortify ourselves to then be who it is that we need to be and to know that that we are so right in doing that. You mentioned three key words there for me: duty, responsibility, and equity. And you said, of course, a number of really great things, but things kind of come back to that, don't they? Duty, responsibility, and equity. And when we look at life, we see where a lot of that seems to be missing, don't we?
That's true. And let me just say a word about equity, because I don't use the word fairness for a particular reason, because that's a weasel word that gets used through the lens of a person's, you know, cultural perspective, where, you know, some people sometimes will use that word to express dissatisfaction with their treatment, but not be seeing that they're coming from a place of privilege in it. And so I prefer the term equity, because that's inarguable. A thing is either equitable or it's not. And it's not squeezed that through any kind of cultural lens. Something's either just or it's not. And so that cleans up the conversation a lot.
Yeah, and we have to determine, as I said in the opening epilogue, is it the right thing to do? And,
yes.
And when we are not doing that which is, in fact, the right thing, there is that within us that gnaws at us, that irritates us, that bothers us until we get on the right side of right. And when we then move into that space and that place, then it doesn't matter who it is that might be coming against us or what people are saying, because then we know that we are right and we are doing the right thing for the right purpose, and all is well in our worlds. And of course, we have a number of people, Gandhi and Dr. King and so many others, who have shown us that in fact is the way to go. But I have to ask you, has that always been the easy way for you to go? You mentioned one example in your own hometown there of not being welcomed in your barbershop. And I know growing up here in Little Rock, Arkansas, the barbershop, and of course that was when I had hair as well, but anyway, that aside, the barbershop was a place where we learned so much about life as a youngster. The barbershop was a place of welcome. It was a place of information sharing. It was a place of everything. So how must that have made you feel to know that now you are not welcomed in your own neighborhood barbershop?
Well, that was very wrenching, obviously. I grew up in a fairly small town of 5,000 and that shop being on what we call Main Street was the center of a lot of activities in the town. So it had a lot of symbolic meaning for me that it felt no longer, not only not safe, but in fact, actually life-threatening to return to the place of my own roots. So that was deep and was a hard one for me to get past, but it was just like a lot of the other, there was a lot of deep isolation alienation as a mm-hmm. result of coming to an understanding that the value system that I had grown up with was fundamentally flawed. It was tilted in the direction of a particular group. My hometown was one of those bedroom communities in Michigan that was built from the ground up to exclude people of color. A person mm-hmm. of color could not live or work in the town I grew up. In fact, couldn't even be there unless, of course, you were there to, entertain us or clean up after us. That was the reality of what I grew up with. And, of course, that's invisible to us growing up. But coming out of it and getting a sense of the reality, beginning to speak to it was so threatening to the very people I'd grown up with and loved that they, literally threatened to kill me. That was a tough one to overcome. But you know what I've come to with it and a lot of the other stuff is it's hard being an ally. It's hard work being the one to raise the voice. But on the other hand, it's easy in the sense of now that I know what I know, it would be a lot harder for me to remain silent in a lot of ways.
Right.
So just like you were saying in the beginning, doing the right thing, doing the just thing, easier, even though it's hard,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does. And, of course, you and I share a military background. I was in the United States Air Force during the Vietnam opportunity. And then I, too, got out of communications intelligence and transferred into the medical field as a special procedures X-ray tech. And so a lot of the things that I saw, both from returning wounded warriors' experiences and where it was that they were eye-opening for me as well. One soldier who obviously had grown up with an idea of racism as being the only way to go, and he happened to have been white, and he was from the Deep South. But here he had a soldier helping him who was African American, who was black at that time. We were black, so we were African American. It changes according to certain specific things, but the fact is that we are all one. And what I learned from dealing with him was to see his acceptance and how it was that he changed by the time he had to leave there. And we became very, very good friends. And so both of us had to let go of some of our past in order to experience that. Did you or have you seen that as well, Reverend C?
Yeah, certainly from the perspective, from the other side of that, from the perspective of being a white person in a milieu of people of color in a common effort to achieve equity, I had to, confront some of my own demons and stuff, false belief systems, and some of those conversations were not comfortable. But on either side, from my perspective, it was a hard growth experience in a lot of ways. But I'll tell you, the transformation is worth it in that the bonding that happens when you come through that experience and you have genuine allies on both sides of the whatever the issue is, you have a much mm-hmm. stronger sense of the oneness. And that sounds like somewhat what also happened for you and the white soldier that you were treating is that being forced in some ways to confront the divides and work it out is a deep healing experience, which is really very much what's motivating the work that I intend to do with this business I'm forming across the river, which is organized around this notion, hashtag conversations and oneness, which bringing people together to who might not normally, you know, like hook up with each other for conversations, with a deliberate intentionality to have a healing experience, have a spiritual awakening, to reach beyond the difference, what appear to be the differences, to reach for a fundamental unity. That's what I'm after with this kind of idea.
I wonder if you would share that with us again. Did you say hashtag conversations of oneness?
Conversations in oneness.
In oneness,
hashtag.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hashtag conversations in oneness. That's awesome. I want to bring the ladies in because I know that both of them are just chomping at the bit to get into this conversation and to say some things with us. And let me start with Tendai, if I may. Ms. T, do you have something to add or a question relative to the things that you've heard or a question of your own?
Yes, thank you, and welcome, Reverend C. Michael. So happy to have you here and bring in your inspiration and light to this beautiful, already inspiring show. I have had the privilege of being in workshops with Reverend C. Michael, who has facilitated them around the issues. And what I find very interesting is it is under the guise of a religion and a philosophy that speaks about the oneness of God, that we are all God and one with God. And so I would wonder if you could, I guess, elaborate a little bit on how does the topic or the theme and the, I guess, condition, we know that's a human condition, the idea of racism fit in that philosophy, and how does it play out in terms of what your work is, in terms of understanding oneness? Yeah, how does that work?
Well, of course, you raise a very, very important and deep question, and not one that not everyone in our philosophy really understands, because there's a tendency sometimes to think, well, we're all one, you know, so we'll just pray this racism thing away and everything will be fine. And there's an element of truth in that. Prayer always does work, in fact. And we're also dealing not only with the consciousness of, say, for instance, in this group, the four of us in this conversation, but there's also this thing going on, which is the larger consciousness of all of humanity and all its configurations. It's important to understand that thoughts are things. This is what our Psalms teaches. Thoughts are actual things. They're not just amorphous, you know, spirit energy or things like that. They're actually creations that we make when we think thoughts, and none of that ever goes away. So there's this whole body of energy, a lot of it negative, that has been co-created by the human race, that includes things like racism, sexism, homophobia, all kinds of things like that, that is energy that's available for us to tap into when we're not conscious, when we're not awake, and that can drive us if we're not being, spiritually fit. So that's the kind of thing that gives rise to the kinds of events that we're seeing going on today in terms of like Ferguson in New York and places where people are it's true we're all one, and we're also products of our the consciousness of our environment, of our culture, of our communities, and it's driven by consciousness that's related to gender. All that kind of stuff plays into it, and so we also have to factor that in to the conversation. There's institutions that have arisen as a result of this consciousness, and those institutions are running on automatic pilot. They're what's driving our criminal injustice system. They're what's driving our educational system. They're what's driving our economy. That's what's driving our political system, on and on and on. And so when we enter those environments with our enlightened consciousness of oneness, we find ourselves in a sea of muck that, you know, is not just going to go away because we, quote unquote, think it away with our philosophy. This is what Dr. Howard Thurman, for instance, in his landmark book, Jesus and the Disinherited, called the happy philosophy. The happy philosophy says, well, all you have to do is change your thinking and change your life. And if you are already operating from an atmosphere of collectively derived privilege, that's easy for you to say. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then what about the person who's operating at the other end of the teeter-totter? That person has a much taller mountain to climb than you do. So see, all of that has to be taken into account when you talk about change your thinking, change your life. We also have to change our collective thinking. We have to change the way our culture operates. So that's another whole conversation.
But it's
absolutely. We need to have in oneness, in the sense of, rather than designating each other as enemies, we want to approach it from the standpoint of, this is a conversation of oneness, and right now I think you're really confused about where we are in the conversation. So let's start with, you know, having that conversation. Does that make
right.
sense?
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
So we have choice. We have choice in terms of our own choosing the thoughts that will produce or create an outcome that we want. And that is a power that we have also as humans. Is that similar to what you're saying with this, the consciousness that you're talking about that has all that we've ever thought and all that we've ever experienced? Once you become conscious of that, you can make conscious choices in terms of what you want to be about, what you want to do and see in the life of the in your life in the world. And those conscious choices are good, and they are that we are one, and they are that life is beautiful and God is love. And then when you make those choices, then the other stuff can kind of fall away. Not that it wasn't there, it was an experience, but it can fall away and not be the dominant thought.
And also that a lot of the choices that we make are not conscious. So that's going on, as our dear friend Reverend Henriette Earle would say, simultaneously at the same time while we're making conscious choices. So we still have to deal with that underlying material, which is, you know, where spiritual tools like understanding the teachings of the esoteric religions and scriptures like the Bible can come into play.
Absolutely. I want to ask you folks to stand by for a moment. Great question. And Carrie, I have not forgotten you. By the way, folks, all of your microphones right now are live. And I will keep them that way so that we can have a four-way conversation, and so that as we are right now, we can come in and respond and or ask questions at the time of each other. Just want to remind our listeners that this is the No Show on the Radio by Renford Broadcast Network. We are excited that you have decided to be with us by telephone and by way of the World Wide Web. If you would like to ask a question of my guest, Reverend C. Michael Woodstock, this evening, and you are online, you may type that in, and I will see it, and I will ask that question. If you would like to voice it yourself, because nobody can answer the question the way that you can, and I understand that, please call in at 347-838-9142 and press 1, and we will afford that opportunity for you. You still have time to share this information with your friends. Call them right now. Text them. Tell them there are some great things going on at this phone number and at this website, and you want to know about it because people are talking about the things that we need to hear. People are talking about how all of us can be at one mint, have at one mint with each other and get over whatever it is that we are dealing with, that we are going through. And those are the types of shows, folks, that you'll find here every week. Let me give you just a couple of examples. Later this evening at 8:30 p.m. Central Standard Time, and all of our shows are Central Standard Time, you will find a wonderful show called The Laws of Material Wealth with my good friend James Renford Powell. That show is phenomenal, and all of us want to know how to not only involve ourselves in terms of our spiritual side, but our material side as well, because as we all know, that if we let one side go, then it will suffer, and that will be challenging. So that comes on at 8:30 p.m. The Searchers Roadmap show comes on Thursdays at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, and it's hosted by Rhonda Harrison from Red Feathers Lake, Colorado. Searchers Roadmap was the first RBR show, and it is the longest-running show. Rhonda is a healer and often hosts shamans from around the world at her home 9,000 feet up the mountains of Colorado. The Dream Vision 7 show at 3 p.m. Central Standard Time on Thursday is hosted by Deborah Bouvet from Boston, Massachusetts. Deborah controls a network which broadcasts from an NBC station in Boston around the world on the Internet. Her network is made up of over 100 hosts with a listener base in over 125 countries. And finally, on Saturday, we have the Soul Town, the Sound of Music, broadcast at 3 p.m., hosted from Memphis, Tennessee by Reginald Jenkins. You don't want to miss this show. If you like good music, and we know that you do, you cannot miss this. You do not want to miss it. So make certain that you catch that and catch it as quickly as you can. The Progressive News Weekly show comes on Thursday at 5:30 p.m., and that's hosted by Daryl Clark from New York. This was a long-running show on another network, and then they saw the light. They had an epiphany and came to the right network. Daryl's guests include people like my good friend in D.C., Dick Gregory, and tend to focus on hot issues and current events. And the moderator and co-host is Cecil McDaniel. So please make certain that you catch these various shows. Tonight, it is my pleasure to visit with a phenomenal minister, a person who has experienced life in many, many, many wonderful ways, and he is Reverend C. Michael Woodstock, a passionate person about unlocking the spiritual power that lies beneath the English translations of the Bible and empowering people to do that for themselves. All of us who are in this faith walk know that the one thing that we tell each other is that you have to do it for yourself. I cannot do it for you. As much as I want to, we cannot do it for our children, as much as we want to. We have to do it for ourselves. But we can lead people to the water. We can show them where it is and then allow them to partake of as much or as little as they would like. Carrie Kelly, you have been standing by patiently, and I can't see you. I can only hear you. So I assume that you have not been chopping at the bit, but I know you want to get in here. What are your thoughts relative to our experience thus far?
Well, I am actually excited to hear about the information about the diversity mindset and how that fits into the English translation of the Bible. because it sounds like there is some specific ideas that our guest has about that. So I wanted to hear his thoughts about that.
Okay. Where was he, Michael?
That would be a whole show by itself. very, very. Yes, it's that. The thing about translation is that word trans, that prefix trans, you are moving across cultures when you translate. Anybody who's learned more than one language understands that there's a lot of stuff that's not translatable between different languages because the culture is different. The way people think is different. And that can be powerfully important when you look at a translation of a document of documents that are no longer in existence that were written originally 4, 5, 6 thousand years ago, and trying to understand it through the lens of a culture that is really relatively brand new in terms of, if you look at the English language, modern English is really only a few hundred years old. So you're bound to run across some very bizarre, like translational experiences. And so, yes, absolutely, the cultural, the in terms of diversity, the input into the Bible goes all the way back to the ancient African spiritual traditions. And folks in that milieu thought, felt, and behaved very differently than modern Americans. That then got translated to the experience of folks in the Middle East who were, different still, and folks in from other cultures as well who have adapted the material to their own uses. So you can have profound misunderstandings evolve simply through a misunderstanding in what an ancient word means. I'll give you one quick example that it has to do with gender. In Genesis, in the very first chapter, there's a verse, chapter 1, verse 26, that talks about the Elohim creating man in his own image and likeness. But the word that's translated as man from the original Hebrew is Adam, which does not mean a man. It means a human being, a person of indeterminate gender.
Oh.
So better translated as, let us make people in our own image and likeness. And then there's the whole thing about Elohim being a plural word, and we think that God is a singular thing. So, I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can unpack this material to try to get back to the original meaning of it so you can understand the spiritual content. And along that line, I just want to bring forth something I read today, which was actually an eye-opener for me. It's a very simple statement by Neville Goddard in which he says the Bible needs to be, you need to understand that scripture is mystically true, not factually. Once you get caught up in the notion that whether or not there were two individual people named Adam and Eve in a garden somewhere who ate some fruit, on, and a talking snake, you've got to let go of all that to understand the spiritual significance of that, the deeper mystical meaning of that, which, of course, has its roots in the African myth, story, spiritual story of the creation of human beings through the lens of Isis, Horus, and Set. And Set being the role of the serpent, that is the character, the Egyptian god Set in the ancient religion. And that is the placeholder in that story in the Genesis book. That whole story of the Garden of Eden is an African story. is an Egyptian story that was told several, many thousands of years ago and was ported over into the Hebrew scriptures by people who got it when they were living in Africa. From the story, the cultural story that grew up out of the cultic center in Uno, which the Greeks called Heliopolis, that in the Bible is called Om. That center was right where the Hebrew people lived when they were in Africa. And that's where they got that story. That's one example.
Mm. Interesting. Wow. One of the things that I am seeing here as a question from one of our folks is, and it sounds like this person is a New Thought metaphysician, how do we share information using the Bible with traditionalists who only interpret the Bible literally when we don't? Reverend C. Michael, I wonder if you might tackle that one for us.
Well, first of all, what I would say is that's a good trick if you can pull it off.
yeah.
I have family members who are in that category. And our answer to it is we just don't talk about that stuff. I will do is, see, there has to be an opening. This is a key thing. You can't just go in to a conversation with someone who's in that frame of mind and kind of like barge into their cultural mindset and insist that they, you know, listen to your wisdom. That's not going to work. There has to be an opening. There has to be a willingness to engage in a conversation. So you have to do the groundwork. You have to be able, you have to, first of all, be in a place of discernment about who are the particular folks who are most likely to be willing to engage in a more open conversation. And then you have to be willing also to just let go of your need to fix them and get them to, you know, come to the truth, because that's what they're doing.
That's right. That's right.
They want to save you because they love you. They're concerned, you know, that, you know, you're going to miss the boat and Jesus is not going to love you if you don't, you know, and so on and so forth and all that. So there needs to be a place of just openness to hearing each other out. I like to use techniques like sharing where there's no, what's called crosstalk, no response. You're not trying to fix anything or change anybody's mind, but you're just hearing each other out. Mm-hmm. And that's often a good place to begin. So if you are in a position where you think you have someone who's willing to engage in a conversation, then that's a good way to kick it off. But if people are coming in with these hardened views and positions, it's very difficult to have a meaningful conversation that doesn't end up in just shouting or people being really frustrated. So the groundwork is very important. There needs to be a little trust established. And that doesn't come by picking up the phone and calling my brother and saying, hey, you know, I want to talk to you about this thing about homophobia. You guys don't like gay people. That's not going to go
That's
well.
Right. Sure. That's right. Tendai, you had a statement or a question you wanted to make?
Well, I was wondering that since you do the work and unpacking the original text and the meanings, what value is that for people today in knowing, I will say, the word truth and the spiritual content of what is said in the Bible, those who, you know, read the Bible and those who think it's a feel like it's a book that really can serve them in their life? I mean, what's the value of knowing the original text, original, you know, meanings?
That, of course, will vary from person to person, but if there's ones who are convinced that stories in the ancient scriptural text of all religions are unpacking mystical truths, like Neville Goddard is saying, then it can be very valuable to understand the source meanings of those traditions, what these folks, what these ancient writers were really trying to say, unfiltered through our cultural filters, so that we can discern to what extent it does apply to what we're going through today. Also, by doing the work to go back from translation to translation to the original is another excellent way to transverse cultural divides, to understand how things get distorted across cultural barriers and lines, can be a wonderful learning opportunity for seeing how that works in today. You know, how many conversations have we experienced across cultural lines that where people walk away going, what did you say?
Right, absolutely.
That's cute because of the difference in how we are filtering. And so it takes real patience and willingness to do that inner translation work. And working with scripture is one way to practice that, by going back and re-looking at English translation words and understanding what lies behind them is a way to kind of build that muscle of cultural diversity and become willing to see things through a different lens than the one you grew up with. That can be a very valuable training in and of itself on the way to discerning deeper levels of truth and understanding how our spiritual traditions have been warped and distorted through a cultural lens, through what I would term a Eurocentric lens that sees the world differently than the ancient Afrocentric world did. And it really distinctly shifts how people understand things at a really root level when you put it through that Eurocentric filter. It changes the original meanings, it changes the spiritual content, it really changes everything. So it's an important exercise just for one's own individual spiritual development. And then, of course, when you're working with cultural diversity issues, which are themselves a product of the dominant culture, the Eurocentric culture that looks at the world through a very different lens than most people do, it becomes exquisitely important to understand how that lens operates and how we can transcend its limitations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's great. Thank you so much.
At the same time that we are doing that, and we are more open and receptive and responsive to doing things of that nature, sometimes the people that we are in conversation with are a lot more closed-minded. So I like what you said about recognizing who it is that you're speaking to and whether or not, as I say, they are interested in conversation or conversion. Because if they're interested in conversion and in converting me, we can't go anywhere. But if they're interested in conversation, then we can talk about what it means to me when the 14th chapter of John says, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me." And then I can share with them from the metaphysical perspective how that has impacted my life, and then we can move forward and ask, and then I ask them to do the same with me, and then they share, and then whether we agree or disagree, it's okay, but we have shared with each other in an open format that leads to further dialogue. And so I really applaud what you are saying and what you are doing with this work, and the time is now. The time is right now, and the time is good because people are looking and searching for answers to know how to talk with each other, and that they don't have all of the answers. So I think that those are great ideas. Carrie, did you want to come in here as well?
Oh, yes. So glad you brought me in right there where you're talking about looking for answers, because for a while, and I'm not even sure that I'm completely over it, I have had what I called multiple spirituality disorder, because I was looking for truth all over the place, and I was very open to finding out what I could find out, but there was all these mixed messages about everything that I was learning, but I was having experiences, I feel, on a spiritual level, no matter where I was going. And if I listened to one person, they would say, oh, that's not a good spiritual experience that you need to go looking for, but it felt fine for me, and on, you know. So how does one handle looking for the truth, but maybe not finding it in all the right places, or finding it in all the wrong places? I don't know how we work that out.
Well, that's a sort of universal problem that I think that people face when they're on their spiritual journey, is finding a place that's supportive of where you are as an individual. And that's a matter of, you know, doing the research and the shopping around to find that comfortable place. But I know that it has to be for someone who's looking at this in the way that I'm convinced the four of us are looking at it, a way in which it's okay to explore. But a lot of places,
absolutely,
it's not okay to explore. I mean, you come in, here's what we believe in, this is what we ask you to believe in if you're going to be with us. Then that's not a place that's going to be particularly comfortable for a seeker. If you're already convinced of that belief system, then fine, that's going to be a comfortable place for you. But if you're, you know, like in that place of being a seeker and looking for answers and wanting to be open, then you really need to be in a place that's comfortable with seekers. That's going to be a place that's going to be stressing esoteric teaching, the unity of all religions, the underlying oneness of all life and reality. And those are places that are not going to be fixated on the doctrine or the dogma of their particular belief system, but more on wisdom teaching in general, wherever you find it. So those are sort of the guidelines for it. That's the litmus test, is when you walk in the door, you know, are they looking to steer you towards a particular doctrine, or are they looking to support you in a spiritual practice? Someone a long time ago told me that, you know, the typical, most typical religions or institutional religions, especially in our country, have things upside down. A person's spirituality needs to serve their religion, and the religion needs to serve the institution, the church. Mm-hmm. It should be the other way around. What we're looking for is spiritual institutions that are supportive of religious curiosity, which are in turn supportive of individuals' spiritual growth. And that's the way organizations like Centers for Spiritual Living operate, or Unity, or Agape, or esoteric philosophies that of various sorts, or things like that, or Hinduism or Buddhism are often places where that can happen. So that's the thing, that's the framework to be looking for as a seeker. Am I in an environment that is supportive of curiosity and someone who's in motion and moving in their spiritual development? Or is this a place that's looking for you to, you know, stick your square peg in the round hole here?
That's right. Absolutely. And, you know, the other part of that, Reverend C. Michael, is the fact that oftentimes when we are most challenged with wondering why it is that we are where we are, and we have allowed that question to well up from deep down within the recesses of our being, then all of a sudden the answers will come. And it will be a space, it will be a place, it may come from a child, it may come from television, it may come from wherever it is that it comes, but through spiritual awareness, if we are spiritually aware at that moment, then we will know that the answer has come for us, and we can do whatever it is that we need to do in order to grow and expand in our consciousness. And so it all, I would think, then has to be about consciousness. Do you not think so?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there has to be a way in which one is setting our foot on the path, and then in a place of trust that, you know, as we are seeking, we will be led.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even the experiences of being, you know, like stepping into a place or a church or some place where we aren't finding the kind of welcoming that we want, even that is a learning experience, and we need to trust that that's just one more step on our path of enlightenment. It's showing us some things that don't work and why they don't work, which is important information.
Absolutely.
So trust, that's absolutely the foremost and one of the most difficult spiritual lessons, at least from my experience. Trust was not an easy one to come by for someone who's been through the kind of life experience I've been through.
Sure, that's right. Well, you know what, ladies and gentlemen, I tell you, these times just boggle my mind with how quickly time runs away from us. Here we are at the end of our discourse, and we haven't even gotten started yet. So, Reverend C. Michael, you have to promise that you will come back so we can do this again. There are lots
Absolutely.
Of things we want to talk about, and we will get to do that. Thank you so much to my panelists who were kind enough to spend some of their LPEs, their life's precious energy, here this evening on the No Show with us. We are grateful, and we realize and recognize, ladies and gentlemen, that you had other choices, that there were other places that you could have been, but you chose to be here, and for that we are eternally grateful. Next week, Reverend Lydia Evans will be with us to share information about spirituality as well. We are so grateful that you decided to stop by here. Let me thank my guest, and I want to give you the last 40 seconds that we have, Reverend C., to just send us out. Tell people where they can reach you, those that would like to send you an email or something. Please share that.
Certainly, mine can be reached at revcmichael@comcast.net. That's revcmichael@comcast.net by email. And I'm also on Facebook. You can reach me there and Twitter. So at C period, at C period is my at SEATERIOD is my Twitter handle. So those are ways to reach me. So
Excellent.
Thank you.
It was my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you so much for being here, Dianne and Perry.
Yeah,
thank you for being with
us.
Thank you.
May you all, and may all of us go forth and have the most fabulous week that we have ever had up to this point until the following week. Everybody take care. God bless. We'll see you.
God bless.
Bye-bye.
God bless.
Bye.
Thank you.